For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
So 4 weeks away from Shura, so what I'd like to do is work on the Aseres HaDivros, the Ten Commandments as they are known, even though we'll see that that's not an accurate translation at all. So what we're going to do is, I hope to, we'll actually probably, I'll do this in my all-night study session, Shavuos night. But this will be our, we'll use this as our prep. So first of all, just on the sheets, you'll right away notice on the first sheet is the one with all the words, the second sheet is the one with the boxes on the bottom. And that first line, I couldn't figure out how to delete. I must have set up my graph in a wrong way. It repeats the first verse. You see that there?
Yeah.
So just ignore that. I'll have to work that out. Okay, in any case, this is what we're going to do. There is much to discuss in what's known as the Aseres HaDivros, the Ten Commandments. I'm going to be referring to them as the Aseres HaDivros. The reason for that is because the Torah itself refers to them as the Aseres HaDivarim, these ten things, which is our source for the concept of there being ten, even though there are actually, as you'll see, 13 verses. Within the 13 verses, there are several more concepts that we can break down. And therefore, we're going to have to figure out exactly how to break it down into the ten that the Torah, so to speak, gives us, even though there are going to be more than ten ideas listed in here. There are... I'm debating how we should do this. There's a lot to discuss in the paragraph immediately preceding the Ten Commandments, and there's a lot to discuss in the paragraph immediately following the Ten Commandments. What we're going to do is we're going to focus just on the Aseres HaDivros. If there's time in the next 4 weeks, I hope we'll get to compare these ten to the ten. The Ten Commandments are given twice in the Torah, once in the book of Shmos, at the original giving of the Ten Commandments, on Har Sinai, and then they're repeated by Moshe at the very end of the Chumash in the book of Devarim with a number of differences. And it's a worthwhile study to do that as well.
So, you should probably lay the one here where this is.
Correct. So I don't mean to call you my guinea pigs, but you're my guinea pig. So now we're going to use this shiur to sort of hone the presentation and to hone all the sheets and what works and what doesn't work, and that's going to be part of the process. So I really appreciate your being here.
Except they're not kosher.
Incidentally, they're not. That's right. You're going to be my goldfish.
That's
fish. No, you can't eat a goldfish.
You're
going to be my salmon.
Goldfish carp.
Yeah, you'll be my salmon.
Yeah. Okay.
Better than lab rats, I agree. Okay, so let's go. So the way they want to do it is we're going to do this in our general procedure. We are going to go through just the text at first. We're going to raise as many problems, questions, comments as we can. And then we'll go through a little bit in the time we have, some Rashi, some Ramban, some Rav Hirsch, and try to pluck out that which there is to see on in this second. I would love to take notes. That's great. Thank you. I was just thinking, I wish I had a pen on me. I know. What kind of rabbi doesn't carry a pen or a pencil?
Would you prefer a pen?
Okay. Either one is fine.
Sort of another expression.
Look.
What's that?
Graduate students.
You could be my graduate students. Isn't that pleasant? Isn't that pleasant? Okay, ready? Here we go. Now, again, we're going to try to work on the translations, which are not going to be perfect, but we'll work with them as it may be. Okay, leading up to this, we, the Jewish people, have come to Mount Sinai. They are there on several days before the 6th of Sivan. They are given 3 days of preparation in which they're told to get ready, to change their clothes, get everything set. There's an entire dialogue. We once went through this, for those of you who were here, on the original Tuesday was a Chumash class. When we went through the Parsha, we learned through the Psukim, the verses leading up to the giving of the Torah. Moshe goes up and down the mountain 5 or 6 times in the days leading up, delivering messages from the Jewish people to Hashem, from Hashem to the Jewish people, and back and forth. And there's a lot to discuss exactly what takes place from the time they actually get to Har Sinai until the actual Torah is given. We are not discussing that. We're just discussing at the end of all of that preparation, we have Vayidaber Elokim, verse 1, and God spoke all of these words, Lemor, saying, we have here the translation to respond. We're going to leave that aside for now. So you have Hashem here speaking. So again, what do we get out of verse 1? What's the main focal point that the Torah wants us to get out of verse 1?
God spoke.
Correct. Who's speaking? God is the speaker. That's the whole introductory verse is that God spoke. Now, let me just give you one little hint. When you see on your English, you will see little spaces periodically on the English side, like in between verses 1 and 2, for example, in between verses 6 and 7, in between verses 7 and 8, and then again between 11 and 12, 12 and 13, and then within verse 13, each one has a space. That is because in the Torah text itself, there is an actual space. There is a paragraph break. There is a space of 9 letters. That's just a break, an open area, and hopefully as by next week I'll have it. Well, I won't have it next week because I'm going out of town, but I'll have for you where you can see what the actual text looks like in the Chumash, where you can see actual paragraph breaks in the text. So I've put that in there for you. So opening verse message is, God is the speaker. God spoke these words saying. Ready? Here we go. I'm not going to label them. Let's just go through them. Verse 2. I am the Lord your God. Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeisicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, who took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Comments, questions on our opening verse here of the Aseres Hadibros.
Definitely establishing what he's done for them already.
Excellent, right? Establishing the relationship. I am Hashem, your God. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. And how am I establishing that relationship?
I'm talking to you. I'm the one who took you.
Correct. Meaning, I was like, what? In what is God saying to the Jewish people in this introductory remark? Now, again, remember where we are in the context of history. This is the very first time that Hashem is speaking directly to the people. We have had numerous communications at this point. This is now 7 weeks out of Egypt. When they were in Egypt, how did Hashem communicate to the people?
Through Moshe.
Through Moshe, always. Always through Moshe or through Aaron, but never directly to the people. Yeah?
You said this is the first time he spoke. Does he ever speak directly to the people?
Here, yeah.
But I mean, besides here.
No, not just
the first time.
What I mean is first, meaning this is actually the first time, but I get you to say the first and only.
Okay,
that's correct, yes. So they haven't had any direct communication. They're not prophets. They're hearing it, whatever they're hearing the message is through Moshe. Moshe has established a pretty good track record, given the year that went through in Egypt and the miraculous events. We've been through the splitting of the sea. We've been through 7 weeks of man falling from the heaven, a well miraculously traveling with them, pillar of cloud during the day, a fire at night. There's been numerous opportunities for them to see, so to speak, the hand of Hashem. They have not directly communicated. This is now the first communication. And Hashem opens up that communication with Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am Hashem, your God. And then how does He establish the relationship? I took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Comments?
Jesus, both two names of God.
Okay, two names of God. Hashem, the name of Hashem, which we don't pronounce, and Elokecha, your God. Okay, what else? Good.
Letting them know that he knows that they were slaves in Egypt.
Okay, so we have from the land of Mitzrayim, that's the physical land that they just came out of, just 7 weeks prior. And what was that land about? It was a base of Avadim, it was a land or a house of bondage for you. What alternative way could God have introduced himself as? Correct. Creator of the world. So in other words, God here has the opportunity to introduce himself to his people. He has at least two major possibilities that we could come up with. I'm sure there are many others as well. But the two big ones would have been, I am God. I created everything. I'm the creator of heaven and earth. I'm the creator of you, the sky. He could have gone that route. He does not. And instead he goes which route? Much more personal routes. The root that says, all of you here standing in front of me, just 7 weeks ago, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Mitzrayim. And that's the way that he introduces himself. Is this one of the mitzvos? In other words, here we have the word Aseres Hadibros, the 10 statements or 10 sayings. In English, again, we keep calling them the 10 commandments, which is not the way the Torah refers to them. The Torah refers to them as the 10 sayings. Do we or do we not have a mitzvah in this opening line? Is there a commandment here? Simple answer is?
Yes.
What's that?
It's implied.
Believe in God.
Okay, well, what we don't have here, which is, you could see for yourselves, what we don't have here, what's the language that we have for at least out of the 612 out of the other 613 mitzvahs? Right, a mitzvah is, the English we would translate as a commandment. So by definition, all of the mitzvahs of the Torah have to have some form of a do this, don't do that. This is what you're obligated to do. Feed the hungry, clothe the sick, send away a mother bird, don't eat this food, don't wear this type of clothing with wool and linen. Is there a action verb in this verse? This verse is a statement. I am Hashem, your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt. This will be, as I'm foreshadowing, a major discussion amongst the commentaries. Is there something for us to do with this first verse, or is it simply a statement? Okay, but that's the first verse. Let's move on. Pasuk Gimel, the third verse. Lo yelecho Elohim acherim al pano. You shall not have the gods of others in my presence. Literally, it would translate as in my face. Al panoi. Panoi is a face. So there should not be any other gods on my face, in my face. Loosely translated as in my presence. Comments. Okay, so this was the statement coming out of the land of idolatry, in a land of sorcery, a land of all sorts of other concepts. So after introducing himself as I am Anochi Hashem Elokech, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Mitzrayim, we have the verse of you shall not have the gods of others in my presence. Continues.
Yeah. Also would be, where is his presence?
Yeah.
Where is his face?
Okay, like what would that mean, Al Panoi? Excellent. What exactly does it mean, Al Panoi? Is there a place, so to speak, in the world that's not Al Panoi? So I guess we would start almost by saying, so therefore, what does it mean, the verse? Therefore, you can't have them anywhere. There is no place that's not considered Al Panoi, that's considered in my presence. Therefore, you would not be allowed to have them anywhere. Which would then just add, we would then rephrase the question, why would God use that language of not having other gods on my face, Al Panoi, which implies in certain areas, which you then say to yourself, well, where is there an area that's not? Oh, it's everywhere. Just say anywhere. It's an interesting way of describing you could never have any other God anywhere by saying it Al Panoi. Certainly an interesting phrase. Let's move on. Lo sa'as elecho fesel, you shall not make for yourself a graven image, v'chol tumuna, or any likeness, asher bashamayim mima'al, v'asher ba'aretz mitochas. That is, you can't have any image that's not in the heavens above, nor on the earth below, va'asher b'mayim mitachas la'aretz, or which is in the water beneath the earth. So following up a verse 3, that you can't have for yourself any other gods, you also can't make for yourself, lo ta'as elecha, do not make for yourself a pesel, an image. And what can the image not be of?
Anything that would
have been... Well, specific. The Torah is being specific
heaven,
here.
Yeah. And in the
water. Okay, anything on heaven,
earth.
On earth, or in the water. So, is this a repeat of verse 2, or is this something different than verse 2?
Well, it's talking about images here.
2 or 3?
So, I want to know... I'm sorry, verse 3. Is verse 4 a rephrasing of verse 3, or is verse 4 somehow fundamentally different, teaching us something new?
Something new,
it is, but I don't know what.
Okay, something new. Okay, let's take that first suggestion. What is new?
Making sure we know what not Well, it was just not
getting specific.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what can't we do in verse 3?
In verse 3, we can't have gods of others.
Other gods.
Here it's just saying don't make a graven image, but it's not saying that you would be worshiping. Don't make a graven image.
Okay, so let's take that. In other words, what's prohibited in verse 3? Let's say all we had was verse 3. What's prohibited?
None of the gods
theology.
That were around.
Right? So, theology. What's prohibited in verse 3 is belief.
That something else exists.
Correct. That's what it sounds like, right? Do not have other gods in my faith, in my presence. That would sound like a theological prohibition. You may not believe in any other power. Right? What happens now in verse 4?
That's specifics.
Yeah, what kind of specifics?
Materialistic specifics.
Right, now in verse 4 you can't make for yourself an image, be it of the stars or a celestial being, be it of an earthen type being, be it of a fish or aquatic type being. You can't make for yourself an image.
Even if you wanted to make God into an image. You keep God, but you make an image of Him. You can't do that.
Okay, so that would be a suggestion of even if I'm not in violation of verse 3 because I still only believe in the one God, I just want to make an image of God, I couldn't do that. Or how about, let's just make up an example. Let's say I'm a businessman and I happen to live in an area where, indigenous to the area that I live, there are people who believe that the stars have powers. So I want to make images of stars to sell to them.
Yeah.
Right? I don't believe in it, but I want to make the images as a business venture. Is that prohibited from verse 3?
No.
Verse 3 says, do not have the gods of others in my presence. Well, I don't believe that the stars or anything, but is that prohibited from verse 4?
Yes.
Right? So a starting point, I think, would be verse 4 is prohibiting simply making an image, whether it be in the heavens, whether it be on the earth below, whether or not it be in the sea, beneath the earth, you may not produce an image of something that has some divine purpose. Or even not divine purpose. What if I wanted to make a sculpture of the star or of the sun simply because I'm an artist? Am I allowed to do that?
Not allowed to do is pray to it.
So is that what verse 4 says?
No.
Verse 4 says, you shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness which is in the heavens above. And it would sound like if we took verse 4 in a vacuum would be prohibited regardless of its divine nature or not. You simply like drawing pictures of... Well, I want to leave out drawing pictures. In other words, we have to figure out whether or not included in making a graven image, does that only include literally making some type of a sculpture, or can that even include simply drawing a picture?
I would think it would be drawing a picture to a certain extent, which opens up another kind of worms. Because you could have pictures of Yashka and, you know, different things. Oh, it's just somebody that was supposed to be whatever when, and, you know, that's not a thing. But, like, say you like the ocean and the sea, and you want to draw a landscape, you know, is that us there also? Because, you know, is that...
Excellent. Those are real questions. Like, what is within the extent of this prohibition?
It says graven image or any likeness. So the or any likeness would be the...
Seems like it would be even a drawing. You know, you have two words that are prohibited. You have the word pesel, which is a graven image, which would sound like some type of statue or figure. And then you have a tumunah. Tumunah in modern Hebrew just means a... Anybody know what a tumunah is? It's a picture. So what's included in the word tumunah would be any likeness, could be much more broad than simply the prohibition. Now the question would then be, well, how realistic does it have to be? In other words, I can draw a sun in my stick figure on a piece of paper. Is that considered in the likeness of the sun? Or does it have to be certain artist renditions actually look like the stars or a fish or
the ocean,
whatever it may be, does it have to be in the likeness in which it actually looks realistic, and that it becomes prohibited? Okay, but these are all going to be very valid questions for discussion.
What's the answer?
No answers.
Answers? Answers, you say?
Because all of these things...
You know, my rule is if you came here for answers, you're going to be sorely disappointed. Yeah.
All of these images, the fish and the sun, etc., become religious symbols for different other religions.
Correct. Very often.
But some, you have it in your house above your fireplace, a ship, a landscape.
Right, right. I was wondering that, too, because my parents have a beautiful picture that my father's an attorney, so... You know, they barter, and they've got a beautiful picture of a boat and it's a seascape. So
yeah, I mean we have. I mean all your pictures. I mean people have in their house. By the token. Wait. That's another story. What about family pictures? What about you know we have my parents' wedding pictures. Well, all a family. You put that on the wall.
Okay. So all I'm pointing out right now is the we're talking about the Ten Commandments. I'm not bringing some obscure verse that you've never heard of before. These are the Ten Commandments, and you're now asking a question that says, well, wait a minute, is the picture hanging over my fireplace a problem?
Exactly.
I'm like, well, that's an interesting question, but I'm not bringing in any wild sources over here. We're just reading...
But right, does it extend to it? You know, does it extend to things that you saw, you know, pictures that of not specifically anything, geometrics or whatever?
I would suspect that some of the rabbis years ago determined that things that we have today are acceptable.
I hope so, but that's starting from the answer and then working our way backwards.
Yeah. So I have to tell you, you know, that the fish that is on the back of people's cars, when we first came back from Europe, when my kids were little, they said, can we have one of those little fish things to go on the back of the car? And I had to call Rabbi Flatus and say, I've never seen this before. What is this? And he told me...
Not for us.
But what about jewelry also, Emog and David?
Question.
Okay, so
all right. Yeah.
What about the Kerubim and the Bechamikdash and the pictures on the Parochus?
What's going on? I can't hear y'all.
Yeah, y'all have to speak loud. Please, seriously. I have a hearing problem.
Okay, so we're just asking various questions.
Yeah.
We have like the images of the Kerubim, the cherubs, and the... In the Beis Hamikdash itself, in the Holy Temple. So these are all good, valid questions.
You have cherubs on the by the Torah, the whatchamacallit.
Are you going to shut down our entire shul just in one afternoon?
Yes, we are. I'm trying to keep it open.
Okay, let's move on. We got a lot of cover. Verse 5. Pasuk, you may neither prostrate yourself before them nor worship them. Ki anochi Hashem Elokecha, because I, the Lord your God, am a zealous God. El kana, kana from the word kina, jealousy. Poked avon avos al banim, who visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the sons. Al shile shim vi al ribeim lisonai, upon the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me. I'm going to read verse 6 because it's one thought. Ve'oseh chesed la'alofim, and I perform loving kindness to thousands of generations, li'oy havai, to those who love me, u'lishomrei mitzvosai, and those who keep and guard my commandments.
Is the word zealous or jealous?
The word is... Yeah, you can get it on a scroll and we'll compare and contrast.
But you didn't think this session was going the way it's going?
No, I fully expected that.
Oh, okay.
Listen, if I came here to be bored, I would cancel this class. This is, this is a give and take. All right, let's see how art school translates. Jealous. They go with jealous. Archical goes with jealous, and this translation right here, is zealous. So we'll take a look at that. Kel kana, a jealous God. Okay, let's look at these two psukim, three verses altogether, 4, 5, and 6. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or likeness which is in the heaven above or the earth below or which is in the water beneath the earth. You shall neither prostrate yourself before them nor worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, who visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the sons, upon the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. And I perform loving kindness to thousands of generations, to those who love me and those who keep my commandments. Comments, questions?
The continuity is hard to follow. All of a sudden, I mean, you shouldn't worship them, and then where does the those who hate me?
Excellent. I was going to very hard to follow the flow of thought. Where is the Torah going with this? Verse 3 makes a lot of sense. I don't want to have any other gods in my presence. Verse 4, a nice follow-up of that. Not only can you can't make any images of other gods, whether they be in the heavens or the earth or in the water. Verse 5, the first half, again, is a very straightforward follow-up of that. Not to believe in other gods in the theology, not to make other gods. And now you can serve the other gods. You shall not prostrate yourself before them or worship them. Which, again, the reason why I'm phrasing this way is, if I would have done it one way, and the Torah doesn't, then the question is, why am I wrong? So I would have put the first phrase of verse 5 right after verse 3. You shall not have the other gods of others in my presence. Don't prostrate or worship them. Yeah. And then I would have gotten to the physical manifestation, don't make anything. So, but we have a very interesting order. First, the Torah says, do not have any other gods in my presence, which we thought meant theology. Then the Torah gets into the specifics of, don't make anything. And then it gets back to, don't serve it, worship them. Now, maybe verse 5 is only referring to the images that you've made. Don't worship them or prostrate yourself before them. But it's certainly within the theme of idolatry. Don't get involved in idolatry, in believing in it, in making them, or worshiping them in the form of prostration or any other type of service. Which, again, I'll just comment now, we have the two different types of service. And you have the actual prostration, tishtachavelahem, don't bow down to them, or losa avdeim, don't serve them, which it seems like a very broad, in whatever method one would serve such a god, you can't do that either. Right, so far so good till the first half of verse 5. It's a consistent flow of idolatry. Various forms and elements of idolatry, but one big no-no to idolatry. So far so good? And then we have this reason. Key. Because. For. Why can't you bow or prostrate? Because I am a jealous God. Because I am your God, and I'm a jealous one at that. So let's stop right there. Is that a logical, is that how you would describe the reason for the prohibition of idolatry? Would you use the phrase, the reason why you can't have idols or bow down or serve them is because I am your God, a jealous God?
Well, that's why zealous was in there, because that's a powerful thing. And if we've got this powerful God introducing himself, then he explains a little bit what they can't do, and then he says, this is how I punish if you break that.
Okay, so that's why you like zealous better than jealous.
Well, I don't like either one of them better than the other, but I'd always
read the
jealous.
Okay, well, let me...
Well, zealous, like a jealous is somebody who is...
Yes.
And, you know, so Hashem is... I can't get the words. But Hashem also, I want you to know, I'm not only jealous, I'm, you know, this is really, I don't, you know, it's like when you say, get out of my face, you know, don't do this, I don't want any of this stuff in my face, and it makes the point, like...
Well, if we had to give a reason why you couldn't be involved in idolatry, what would be the simplest reason? If a child were to come to us and say, why can't I serve idolatry? What would be our answer to the child?
Torah says not to do it. Hashem said not to do it.
Maybe I'm thinking this more simply. What?
It doesn't... idols don't exist,
That's it. Because... Because it's not, because it's false. What would be the most straightforward explanation if a child came and said, I'd like to serve this tree. I'd like to worship the sun.
You say, well, we appreciate all these things because they're from Hashem. Hashem made them. So you know, not, you
You're
know.
Giving a, such a far more sophisticated answer. What's the simplest answer to the child who says, I want to worship the sun?
Why?
Right. Well, what do you mean when you say why? What do you really, I mean, what would you say?
What's it going to do for you?
Right. There's nothing there to worship.
By using a zealot or a jealous, you're applying an emotion to God, which is a difficult concept.
Okay, so continuing with our question. So I'm throwing water, we're going a little haphazard in the way we're asking, which is fine. The very fact that, why does God give, what's the reason he gives? Notice he starts off, verse 2, I am Hashem, your God, I took you out of Egypt. Very good. Then he says, you may not have any other gods, you can't make images, you can't serve them or worship them. Why? Because I am Hashem, your God, and I'm a jealous or zealous God. We'll discuss that translation. Which is attributing not just any emotion, but as we've been saying, a very strong, powerful emotion. Kinah, the most simple translation, jealousy, not only is it an emotion that we're attributing to God, how do we look at that emotion of jealousy?
Negative.
It's a very negative emotion.
It opens up the possibility of another God. What are you jealous of?
Correct. Like, am I jealous of a third grader's ability to do anything? No, I'm not threatened by the third grader. I'm not threatened by a fly's ability to do whatever. So it's in general an interesting phrase. Besides from my point, which is, why don't we just say it straight? Don't serve any other gods because they don't have any other power. So we
that acknowledges them, kind of acknowledges. If you say, don't serve any other god, you're saying that another god exists, just that he's not as powerful as Hashem. And they don't exist.
You're asking, you're furthering my question?
I'm responding to it.
You're responding to it against it, why it's not a question?
Yeah, but you're saying, you know, don't do it with any other gods. That by saying... It acknowledges that other gods exist.
So that's a question. You're furthering my question.
Okay.
In other words, let me just say, the way that Hashem says it here is, don't worship them because I'm jealous. Mm-hmm. That says there is validity to them. Mm-hmm. Don't follow after them because I'll be jealous of them. Mm-hmm. As opposed to have saying, don't worship or serve them because...
It's
silliness to do something like that. There's nothing there. He doesn't say it's silliness, there's nothing there. He says, I am God, and I'm jealous or zealous of anything else. That's an interesting way of describing the reason why we are prohibited from worshiping any other God. Yeah? I'm raising questions here. Yeah.
Trying to formulate. Because he is jealous, right? But he's not jealous of another god because he knows that there is no other god and he's the best. What he's jealous of is when people, you know, he wants people knowing he's the one.
Are you giving an answer?
I don't know.
I think so. That sounds like an answer to me.
Is it a good one? Do you agree with it?
No, it's fine. I'm not commenting on it. I'm just saying, in other words, I'm pointing out the text. The problem of the text. The problem in my mind of the text is when God gives us a reason for idolatry, which he didn't need to give a reason at all, but he does. What's the reason why we're prohibited from idolatry? Because I'm a jealous God.
Well, but then he follows it.
Okay, so let's get the follow-up. Who visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the sons, upon the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. And we said, like, where is that coming from? Just a strange phrase. It's a difficult phrase to understand in any context. Just what is the meaning of this phrase? It's doubly difficult to understand in the context in which we're being presented this phrase. So let's just try to understand the phrase itself in a vacuum and then try to put it in context. What does it mean Poked Avon Avos, who accounts for or visits the iniquity. The Avon means iniquity, the sins of the fathers upon the sons, upon the third and fourth generation. What does that sound like it's saying?
He holds a grudge.
Correct.
He has a long, long memory.
Right? It sounds like he holds a grudge. In other words, if a father sins, who's going to pay for that? Not just his son, but for the third and fourth generation will pay for the crimes of their father.
Yeah, why do that? You know, even if the son, you know, what if the son does tshuva? What if the son, you know, the
excellent. This seems to fly in the face of almost everything that we would believe in, that here we would have a child being punished for the acts of his father. So you say, I don't understand. If the father does it one way, acts in a certain way, and it's a negative, evil behavior, and the child does not follow in that path, so then you would ask, why in the world should the son be punished for the actions of the father? That doesn't seem just. And if the son is indeed following the path of his father,
isn't that punishment enough?
So then you say, well, what's the relevance of the father's act to be punishing for the son? Let the son be punished for his own acts. So under what circumstance does it make sense? Is it just? And I use that word very specifically because we assume that God is a God of justice, which was Abraham's argument when, if you remember, Hashem said he wanted to destroy the city of Sodom, and Abraham said, are you not going to do mishpat? Are you not going to have justice? So here we have, again, we're not even putting this in context, just in a vacuum, a very strange line that God says, I will visit the sin of fathers not only upon their sons but upon the third and fourth generations, lisonai, to those who hate me. So are the ones who hate me, is that referring to the father who sins? Is that referring to the third and fourth generation who continue the sins of the father?
Hopefully the ones.
And why is worshiping idols an action of hatred to God?
Okay, what would you say it is?
Denying.
Okay, something else. Okay, so let's break down what we're dealing with right here. So number one issue is, in a vacuum, the line itself is difficult. What does it mean that God visits the iniquity, not just for what generation after the actual sinner, but to his son, grandsons and great-grandsons, those who hate me? That's a hard phrase. In context, now I'll add that to the context, why is this here? Meaning, we're talking about idolatry. So in the context of idolatry, so God is saying, serve me and no one else. I'm a jealous God. All the difficulties that we pointed out with that. And now we have, and apparently I'm a not just a jealous God, but now in the context of idolatry, I'm a vengeful God, in that I will mete out punishment not just to you, but to the third and fourth generation, specifically here in the context of idolatry. And then we'll add Yehuda's point of idolatry. I wouldn't have put that as hatred of God. I would have said somebody who fails and falls into idolatry. If we had to come up with words, so you came up with abandonment or disbelief. I remind you guys that in the times of Tanakh, when there was real idolatry, it would be idolatry in conjunction with serving Hashem. It wasn't necessarily one or the other, it just was a desire that people had. So I don't know that that would be hatred in as much as a powerful desire of...
ignorance.
Could be ignorance. Again, we're post the desire for idolatry, so we look at it as silliness. But I don't know if it was just there was a pleasure involved, there was a abandonment. But it is interesting that in the context of idolatry, God says, I visit this punishment upon people because you hate me. Which is very interesting. I don't know that we would have come up on our own again. Anytime we would not have come up with a word, and the Torah does, again, you have to ask, so why are we wrong? Where is the element of hatred in this idolatry? Okay, but then he continues. The Torah then goes on and says, and I perform loving kindness to thousands of generations, to those who love me and to those who keep my commandments. So what do we see here, first of all?
Choice. Hate me and this will happen to you and love me and this will happen.
Okay, we have the two options, which is interesting. Either you hate God or you love God. What about the neutral option? It's not listed here. So one set of behaviors are because you hate me. You can have another set of behaviors because you love me. What about the apathetic person? Whatever, God's there. I have no emotional feelings for him. That's not listed. I'm not saying it's impossible, I'm just saying it's not listed here.
If you're saying, well, you know, maybe he's there, isn't it an arrogance saying, well, you know, if I need him, maybe I'll call on him. But, you know, right now I'm doing fine. I'm in control of my life, so...
And therefore you're saying, really, maybe there are only two options. In other words, if you believe he's there, then you either have to love him and follow him, or by definition will be some form of hatred.
What's,
maybe.
What's the word?
Which one?
Hate.
Lison oi, the last word in verse 5. Okay, well, what do you see about the difference between God's kindness and God's punishment?
Thousands of
right, incomparable.
I've always been puzzled because thousands of generations. I mean, have we?
How many generations have we had? Excellent. Okay, so let's do it in stages. Number one, we see God says, "When I mete out punishment to a sinner, how long will that extend for? To a third or a fourth generation?" You can ask the same question. A Talmudic question on that would be, which one? Is it three generations or is it four? If it's three, why'd you say four? If it's four, why'd you say three? Is it either or? If it's either or, what's the criteria for determining if it's three or if it's four? Why not five? And as soon as you say three or four, three and four, that's just, which one is it?
They have a chance between three and four.
So, and four and five doesn't?
Uh-huh.
And four and between four and five doesn't?
Well, then now assuming that they're on the right track.
So but that would be the question of, well, what happens after the fourth generation? Which one is it? So that would be the question. That's all on the iniquity side. And what about on, for those who love me and follow my commandments? Thousands of generations. Thousands. So A, we see again, just on the first level, the difference between punishment and versus reward. The punishment is much more limited, three or four generations, and the reward goes for thousands. What do you suppose that means, that osei chesed, I perform loving kindness? God does kindness to those for thousands of generations who love him and keep his commandments.
Kindness isn't always a good.
What do you mean by that?
You let a baby play with a knife, that's kind, but it's not good.
Okay, and therefore what?
Loving kindness is kindness that is good for you.
Okay, I mean the connotation of the word chesed is something which is in to benefit you. All right, so I put this back in context. What does it do with idolatry? So again, you have the prohibition of idolatry. Do not bow down to them. Do not serve them, because I am Hashem, your God, who is a jealous God. And then we have this description of how he behaves towards us. He will visit the iniquity of sinners for the third and fourth generation, but to those who love him and perform his commandments, so then he'll perform loving kindness to them for thousands of generations.
It's interesting. It says to those who love me and to those who keep my commandments.
Correct.
So there's
almost like two separate things. Mm-hmm. Okay, these first six verses, how many different commandments would you list? Meaning, if you were the Rambam and you were counting up 613 mitzvahs in the Torah, that's your goal, that's your objective. Different mitzvahs that you have, different prohibitions, different positive commandments, and now you come across these six verses. How many different commandments would we count out of these first six verses?
Why do we need them?
You don't. I'm asking a question just for argument's sake. All right, list them.
Well, verse 2, we're not sure of. Verse 3 seems to be a commandment.
Okay, what's the commandment in verse 3?
you shall not have the gods of others.
Okay, we have a good language. Lo yihye lecha. There's a prohibition language. Do not have any other gods. Okay, would you say that verse 4, not making an image or a picture, is the same prohibition, or is that a new prohibition? It's a new prohibition. It sounds like a different prohibition. There's a theological prohibition of believing in any other god. Then we have a physical prohibition of making any other type of image or picture. Verse 5, would we then say bowing or serving? Is that a new, separate than the theological belief, separate than the making of an image? Now we have physical bowing down or serving. Is that a third different prohibition, or is that included within not having any other gods?
Well, since you made it separate, it would be another one.
So you'd have theologically don't believe in any other gods in my presence. We would have do not make any image or in the likeness, pictures or molten images. Then we'd have a third prohibition of actually serving. Would you be willing to break down verse 5 into 2, bowing down as separate from serving? Okay, so that we can debate, whether or not there is a umbrella, do not serve them, whether that means bowing down or whether or not that means bringing them ice cream. But we also could say that those are two separate prohibitions. There's a prohibition of simply bowing down to any god, and then there's a prohibition of worshiping another god in whatever way the means of worship would be. So that technically speaking, we could easily come up with four prohibitions from verses 3, 4, and 5. There could be less, but we could easily have come up with four, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we've discussed verse 2 also as a possibility of the positive mitzvah to believe in God. So as far as our potential count is, we at this point, by the time we've concluded verse 6, have potentially five separate mitzvahs. They're going to come with many more than 10, as I mentioned. There potentially can be five mitzvahs in the first 6 verses. One positive commandment of, I am Hashem, your God. Believe that. Believe in me. Four potential prohibitions. Don't believe in any other God. Don't make any other image. Don't bow down. And don't serve in any potential way in which their service might be. Four prohibitions, one positive commandment so far at the end of 5 verses. So far, so good? How many of the Aseret HaDibros do you think we've covered so far?
One.
Two. It's all one. Two. All right, we'll talk about all this. Yeah.
In verse 3,
mm-hmm.
where it says, you shall not have the gods of others in my presence, it doesn't necessarily say you shall not worship the gods of others, just you shall not have them. I think you were...
I made it into a theological concept of belief. We were saying you shall not have them, so maybe that means not simply possessing some type of physical manifestation of a god. Okay, if we go with that, which I think is a very interesting point, if we go with Dina's suggestion, what we would then have is that verse 3 would be a prohibition of physically owning any form of an idol. Verse 4 would be, you can't make that item, meaning verse 3 only says, I didn't make it. Verse 3 says, you can't have it. Lo yihye l'cha, it cannot be to you that you have any other gods in my presence. Then you have the prohibition of not making them, and then you have the prohibition of not actually serving them. So that what this would net would be, you can't make, you can't own, and you can't serve. I think it's very good. Okay, so far so good? And then the question that we'd be left with at this point would be, in the midst of all of these idolatrous prohibitions, we have the statement of God being a jealous God who punishes 3 and 4 generations and rewards for thousands. And what is that doing there? It just doesn't fit with what the goal is, what we're accomplishing here, which is really giving a very inclusive concept of the prohibition of idolatry. Owning, making, serving, all of those are fleshing out what's included within the prohibition of idolatry. And within that discussion, we have this other discussion about I punish for 3 and 4 generations and I reward for 1,000. And I'm very jealous. Which seems to be the reason given why you're not permitted to have any of these idols. Yeah, so far so good? Let's do one more and then we'll leave it at that. Verse 7. Lo siso eshem Hashem Elokecha lo shav. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Ki lo yinakeh Hashem es asher yiso eshem lo shav. For the Lord will not hold blameless anyone who takes his name in vain. Comments, questions? Very strange, repetitive sentence. Just say the first half of the sentence and you'll tell me everything I need to know. What's the prohibition? Taking the name of the Lord and God in vain. Now the word in Hebrew is sisa, which really means to carry. Do not carry the name of Hashem in vain. You cannot use God's name in vain. And then the Torah gives a reason why you can't. And if I remember my college days, I believe this is referred to as circular logic or circular reasoning. Right? If my child says, "Why am I not allowed to have ice cream at 5 o'clock when they ask me for ice?" They say, "You can't have ice cream now." I say, "Why not?" I said, "You can't have ice cream now because you can't have ice cream now." I say, "No, I asked you why I can't have ice cream." I say, "I know. The reason is because you can't have ice cream now." They say, "No, that doesn't work." So what do we have here? You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Why?
Because they think so.
Because the Lord will not hold blameless anyone who takes his name in vain. Tell me, why can't you name? Because it's a great affront to my honor to take my name in vain. Okay, that's very nice. But here we have, don't take the name of the Lord in vain, because he will not forgive you if you take his name in vain.
Well, doesn't say he won't forgive you, says he
will not hold blameless. Right? Lo yinakeh, will not forgive or cleanse, literally. I wonder how our school translates. Take that. For Hashem will not absolve anyone who takes his name in vain.
I also have a question or something I've observed here.
Mm-hmm.
In verse 7, it switches to the third person.
Mm-hmm.
The name of, you shall not take, where it's up above, he was saying I. So it, you'd think it would say, do not take my name.
Excellent. So that's an excellent point, which one we were going to focus on a lot, and you're picking up on it right away. Who is the speaker in verses 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6? Who's the speaker? I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt. You shall not have the gods of others in my presence. You shall neither prostrate before them, worship, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. I perform loving kindness. Those who love me and keep my commandments. Clear. Who's the speaker? God is the speaker. Verse 7, there's a fundamental shift. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold blameless to anyone who takes his name in vain. Who's the speaker? It's not God. Because we switched from, I am the Lord your God, do not take other gods before me into someone talking about God. This one now seems like it's Moshe speaking. That's going to be a major point which we're going to have to address at length. That verse 7 till the end is going to sound like a fundamental switch into the third person. Okay, we'll continue with this. We will continue, God willing, next week.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.